ya lo hace, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Monday, February 10th, 2020. I'm Kevin Larame, joined by Dwayne Mullins this morning. Dwayne, as always, you know, I've been covered by a big blanket of snow over the last 4 days here in Montreal. It's like it's never going to stop snowing, and it's never going to be dull also covering soccer in Montreal and in Canada. That's for sure. And we'll talk about this later today on the show.
No, absolutely. And we do like to be a weather podcast. Sometimes we are Canadian. It is in our nature, particularly at this time of year, where we are all experiencing the winter fatigue. The charm of the first snowfall is long past. The bright lights of Christmas time in a past memory. You know, even the sort of like we can do this kind of let's go out and skate and ski and all that stuff of early January done. Now we're in February, mid-February, and we're like, just get it done. Just make this stop now. That's where we're at.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we'll just move on, continue to move on with our life. And I'm going to go spend the next 4 hours after the show shoveling, even though I do not own a driveway. Don't ask me why. I'm just going to be shoveling. And on that note, a lot of people are shoveling news this time of the year. And one news that's coming out of Europe is actually getting our lead story this Monday morning, Dwayne. And it is a big one. And it's going to have a lot of ramifications. And for now, we're going to stick to the facts. And the facts are this right now. According to information from RTBF, these facts come from the 2016 to 2018 season. Olivier Renard, current sporting director of the Montreal Impact, was sporting director of the Standard de Liège in Belgium. This club is now implicated in what's called the Footgate scandal in Belgium about players and agents and a kickback scheme of money to have certain amount. But the facts are this here. Olivier Renard is being sued, or the way it's formulated, the police had a complaint formulated to them by the club, by Standard Liège, on him and a couple of other individuals. The agent in this case is Dejan Velikovic, and this agent for years had a scheme of selling players, making money, having a kickback, and he is now collaborating with the police. And it's in his black book, in his little notebook, black book, his blacklist book that he had, that they're finding a lot of things. There was a police search on January 30th at the training center and at the stadium of a Standard de Liège, which leads to everything more that the club has figured out. And the club has deposited yesterday a formal complaint on Olivier Renard and more. Now, the Montreal Impact did answer La Presse in a press release, in a way, saying that Olivier Renard will keep his job during the procedures, and the club also indicated that Monsieur Renard will not comment for now. So those are the facts, and according to the club Standard de Liège and the information from RTBF, the facts noted are two separate cases of €20,000 being accepted allegedly by Olivier Renard. So those are the facts this morning concerning Olivier Renard and the judicial procedures that are against him in Belgium.
Yeah, look, we got to be a little bit careful about an ongoing legal sort of dispute, so we're not going to express opinion here other than to say, I think clearly if these charges are true, then we have a serious issue on our hand, and I don't see how you can continue to have him employed as a Major League Soccer general manager, or technical director in this case, because if you're not completely understanding the seriousness of this, let's express it from a Major League Soccer level for a second. One of the ways that they get the kickbacks is they generally sign these people for a little bit more than maybe their market value is worth, so that the agent gets more percentage as well. It's a scratch back situation. I scratch yours, you scratch mine, and there's a cap in Major League Soccer. So if you just want to even be cynical about it and just look about it from a signing and benefit to your team perspective, it's not good. But as we said, we don't know for sure. The due process is something that we believe in, and we'll continue to follow this and see where it goes, because that's all we can do for now.
But it is a big story, and if you want to know more about this story, I do suggest you go to the RTBF website. I think it's rtbf.be, and it is in French mostly, but you can find help with Google Translate and other outlets now that are covering this story. It's getting some traction. It is going to be a big, big moment in football, I believe, Dwayne, and I believe that's the top of the iceberg. I believe this might be the beginning of people looking at their books over the last 10 years and realizing, oh my lord, exactly. So this could be one of these instances. The fact that it's Olivier Renard is implicated or not is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how it has been known for years and years that this could have been a possibility of scheme across the world of football behind the scenes. We'll see if this is a moment where the behind the scenes become public and there's more cases being made public after this. This could be a pivotal moment in how players, agents, and clubs, and how their relationship all melds together.
Yeah, look, to be clear, this has been rumored not other places in Major League Soccer before. And, you know, I'm not going to imply anything more than that. It's not a new story, but it certainly is new in the sense that there might be some documentation to back this up. And if that's the case, then as I say, I just don't think it's tenable for his employment anymore. But we'll see what comes out of the investigation. And as anyone does, he deserves the due process of that.
Exactly. And it is a story that we'll obviously keep a close eye on. As of right now, the facts are as we mentioned earlier. And you can find more on lapresse.ca, another news outlet that are reporting the facts this morning. Now let's move to Piatti, but not this Piatti, the other Piatti. There's a quota in Soccer Today where every show we need to say the name Piatti, but it doesn't talk about Nacho. I guess this time we're talking about Pablo Piatti. Pablo Piatti joining Toronto FC. Can you tell us a bit more about this signing, the third DP for Toronto FC in 2020? I guess I'm starting to rhyme. I feel like Eminem on the Oscar stage last night, I guess. But yeah, that was, I marked out, I have to say. I was on the couch with my wife, Dwayne, and I was like, oh, they're showing a lot of frames of 8 Mile. Ah, look, at Eminem's going to walk out on stage. And guess what? Eminem walked out on stage. But I'm not here to talk Eminem. I'm here to talk Pablo Piatti. What can you tell me about Pablo Piatti?
50-year-old Marshall Mathers is depressing, by the way. But
what? What? Oh my lord, he's 50 years. Oh my, he's still good.
He's 49, I believe. Still good. Right. That's, if you want to feel old, anybody out there?
Thanks, Dwayne. Dude, now I have a really bad case of the Mondays.
There you go. Quickly on the Piatti thing. In our defense, Kevin, I do think that Piatti is kind of the Smith of Argentina, but nonetheless. Look.
It's the Tremblay. Piatti is the Tremblay of Argentina. Yeah, maybe. Yes, maybe that works.
Yes, in Quebec. All right. So Pablo Piatti, I think a lot of people from the Toronto area are familiar with this story now, but if you're not, quickly, this is a guy that came onto the forefront. Coincidentally, I shouldn't say irony, it's not irony, coincidentally, in Toronto in the 2007 Under-20 World Cup that Argentina won, he actually led the front line, and that was playing alongside Sergio Aguero, and at that time was considered to be almost as good of a prospect. Crude. Didn't quite go the same way as Aguero. I mean, obviously, Aguero would be top 20 player in the world, I think. This is not a player of that nature, but a very good player nonetheless when he has played well. 3 years ago for Espanol in La Liga, he was a 10-10 guy, 10 goals, 10 assists. And I think anyone understands that a 10-10 guy in La Liga is probably a 20-20 guy in MLS.
I was
going to
say 30-30.
Which is an MVP. No, yeah, which right. Is an MVP caliber level. So this is good, but this was 3 years ago. Well, so this is not a slam dunk for TFC by any means, and it is certainly a risky, high risk signing. I would characterize it as. I didn't think they'd bring him in as a DP because of his injury history the last couple of years, because he has not produced close to the 10-10 numbers the last couple of years because of those injuries largely. But nonetheless, the numbers aren't there. His value has dropped. I thought they might be able to get him in as a TAM player, but they did not. They brought him in as a very low DP number. In fact, he's the first DP signing after the CBA in Major League Soccer, and although the new rules have not completely kicked in, TFC appears to be kind of following the spirit of them with this signing.
Yeah.
If the numbers we have heard or reported are correct, which are about $1.6 million a year with a 1-1 contract, so 1 year at 1.6 and then an option, This is essentially a older DP player that is signed at the maximum that will be allowed under the new rules.
Yeah.
And he will fit in as a guy that I think TFC is looking at as a final piece of a team that they think can win a championship this year.
Okay,
well, and maybe next year as well. But this year for sure is absolutely. And that's the first thing I'd say about this. This says the TFC is swinging for the fences in 2020. And why wouldn't they? They are older.
When the final understands that. And you were in the final last year, right?
Yeah, so, in the finals last year, yeah. So, they were half away. They were 45 minutes away from winning MLS Cup last year. So it's not like they're a long ways out.
And a player like this has a big upside. But the question is, how will his injury proneness or his recent health status because of his injuries and his number of games played, but especially his production in these games, is it going to affect him? Is he going to be different? And you mentioned to me before the show that because MLSC is more than just a Toronto FC, Toronto Raptors are also part of this, Toronto Maple Leafs also, but I'm just talking about the Raptors here. And we all know the term load management. Kawhi Leonard famously made this now a lingo. It is part of our vocabulary now. It is a common term. It is a slang. It is part of our vocabulary here. Load management in the sports world. And this could be load management. There's a lot of ways that maybe they'll find ways to make sure that his output of performance is at the highest it could be without having strain on his body and having a chance to re-injure or aggravate some things that were there in the past. So there's that aspect of MLSC that does attract a player like Piatti and might be one of the reasons why Toronto FC feels confident that he can produce for them a way that he hasn't produced for RCD Espanol in the last couple of seasons.
No, I think there's no doubt that the Kawhi Leonard signing for the Toronto Raptors has informed TFC in this. If you are one of the six people that do not know about Kawhi Leonard and the Toronto Raptors, he came in with a very, very similar injury history and ultimately led the Toronto Raptors to the NBA title, which I still can't believe happened. I saw it, but anyway, they think they can replicate that. Now, they're using the same doctor, the same medical staff that is that they used with Kawhi Leonard will be working directly with Piatti to try and help him become that. That's MLSC. It's also partly the gentleman, he's Scottish, the fellow that worked with Kawhi Leonard. You wouldn't necessarily associate that. He's well known in his basketball circles now, but he's also a huge soccer guy. He appeared on James Sharman's podcast a few months ago. If you want to go back and listen to him, he was actually part of the 2000 Gold Cup team as well, and is the physio on that. So this is a guy that has a soccer history. History and likes the sport, so I imagine he's looking forward to the task at hand here. It's a risk, as we said, and if he can stay healthy and can come back to some of his previous levels, then yeah, this is going to be a good signing for the soccer. But if he doesn't, as I said, it's a swing for the fences kind of signing. And the thing about swinging for the fences, if you like baseball, is you know that it's usually an all or nothing proposition. Either hit the home run or you strike out. And there is a possibility this will strike out. But I think that's TFC's 2020 in a nutshell. They're either going to be a contending team, like near the top all year, deep run in the playoffs, perhaps win, or they're going to have everything go wrong at once. And I think that's equally possible right now. And I don't quite know which way I lean yet. I have 2 weeks to figure that out.
Certainly. You're running out of time. But in a way, you're kind of right. We're 8 days away from the CCL, and slowly Dwayne and I will start pivoting towards the CCL in our coverage later this week. But Toronto does not have the CCL this year, so they do have a bit more of a time to address a project and to include a player like Pablo Piatti in that project. It could be a good omen for Toronto to not overextend their stamina in a way, in a way to explain this. Before we take a break and come back and talk about the Olympic qualifiers and the final last night, and of course the semifinals on Friday, where both Canada and the United States qualified for Tokyo 2020, Bradley Wright Phillips, BWP to LAFC. It was a known secret, I would say, a very not good guarded secret, because he had a trial with LAFC, so we kind of figured that if he was going to impress anyone out there, he was going to be an LAFC player, and it happened. BWP will now play for LAFC.
Finally, LA will get a number 99 that they can enjoy and love wearing black.
I kind of figured you were going to go there. Okay, it's another bingo card moment here on Soccer Today. It's a hockey reference. Check. Wayne Gretzky was number 99 for the LA Kings, of course.
Yeah, wore black for LA, yeah. Because they were the black and grays back then. Anyway, putting that aside, he can wear whatever number he wants. But alas, it'll just be weird for me anyway. But I'm maybe old. I noticed that when I suggested that the other day on Twitter. Most of the people that were telling me that I was crazy were about 10, 15 years younger than me. So they
what? They're like, who wore number 99? What are you talking about? Wayne who? What? Exactly.
They don't remember in the same way that those of us closer to my age and older do. At any rate, it's a low risk. I don't imagine he's on a big number. I don't even think it's a high reward possibility. I think it's a low risk, some reward proposition signing. And if you're LAFC, you're in tweak mode. You're looking for things to make yourself a little bit better. And adding a little bit more scoring depth off the bench, which I think is what this will be, is a decent gamble for them for a year. And for Bradley Wright Phillips, gets to go play in the sunshine for potentially the best team in the league for a year, maybe win an MLS Cup, because I think, you know, I 2 weeks out to figure out where I'm going to place Toronto on this list, but I'm pretty confident I know LAFC is going to be near the very top of my preseason predictions.
Yeah, that's a big shocker this year, of course. But yeah, it seems like a good way to say goodbye for a BWP. One year on the West Coast. Make some friends in LA. Score a bunch of goals, maybe about 10 this season if you're lucky. Maybe in a supporting role late in a few games to support Vela and company. And maybe you find yourself with a trophy at the end of the season. That's not a bad way to finish your career if you're Bradley Wright Phillips. And maybe that's the ideology behind it. With New York going in a different way, maybe this is his way to find a last time. In the sunlight. Yes, I didn't make the sunlight reference. All right, let's take a quick break. During when we come back, we'll talk about the Olympic qualifiers in CONCACAF on the women's side in Canada and the United States qualifying for Tokyo 2020.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at Soccer Today SPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
And we're back on Soccer Today. I'm Kevin Larmé. You can follow myself at Kev Larmé. You can follow Dwayne at 24th Minute and this show at Soccer Today SPN, live Monday to Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern, on our Twitter feed, video replay available. Anywhere else you can watch your videos, Facebook, YouTube, and of course Twitter, and podcasts available everywhere you get your podcasts. Our premium podcast feed is at sportspodcastingnetwork.com. You'll find the info, and also at patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. Dwayne, we're back, and it was a big moment in our yearly cycle of, a four-year cycle for the Canadian Women's National Team, where every couple of years, trying to qualify for the Olympics, and that moment happened on Friday night. Jordan Huidema with the goal that propels Canada to Tokyo versus Costa Rica on Friday.
Yeah, win's a win's a win. So we'll start there. And the mission accomplished. The goal of the tournament was to qualify for Tokyo. They did that. So I don't want to be overly critical, as I have apt to be sometimes with this program, because I hold it to the standard that they claim they hold themselves to, which is a world contending team. A huff and puff 1-0 victory over Costa Rica, you know, a team that they vastly have vast more resources than, is not something that inspires confidence, particularly when it's followed up with a 3-0 loss to the U.S. Even if that U.S. had a first good, you know, one good half against the U.S. is not going to change my mind there, right? At any rate, they did get the win. Jordan Huidema had a nice little tournament. She was the Golden Boot winner. Her and Jeanine Becky, I think, are the future of that program when Christine Sinclair starts to ride off into the sunset, or reduce her role. Although in this tournament, Christine Sinclair looked pretty spry still, maybe a step behind. If she had a little bit more speed, maybe she is able to chip the keeper in that first half of the U.S. game. But
I was going
to
say, you could have seen it yesterday during the game against the U.S. where St. Clair was going all out, and it wasn't necessarily about tactically. And it was like, yeah, we're really trying. And she was, like you say, just an inch off of scoring on that chip, on that maybe the best opportunity Canada had in that game. But yeah, you're right. The way she knows her soccer IQ, right, and how she can position herself in a way to being the most efficient almost and not having to spend that much energy and eventually. So, no, yeah, I agree with you. She's still like top five, top 10 player, top 10 player in the world, I would say right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at her, we didn't intend this to be a Sinclair conversation off the top, but if you look at her in the first half against the U.S., where Canada did maybe have its best half against them in the last four or five games they played, one thing she was doing very well was defensively. At the top of that line, she was tracking and closing and was able to make some good contributions on the defensive side of the game, which did ultimately open the U.S. up a bit and allow Canada to get some of those opportunities. Now, the United States of America's women's national team is incredibly good. That is your TLDR of the final.
Wow, Dwayne, that's your bold statement of the day. The two-time defending World Cup champions are really good.
Well, and what they, more specifically, how they're really good is, and I don't, often this word I'm about to use is used as an insult with soccer. I don't mean it this way at all with this team. They are the most athletic team in the world by far. They are able to play at a high tempo for 90 minutes in a way that no other women's team in the world does. They are able to close down. They can swarm defend. They can put pressure on the back line. And that will ultimately, even when they're not at their best, lead to mistakes by their opposition that ultimately they pounce on and score on, because that's the other thing they do well. Yeah. You know, they strike that ball and they find goal in a way that no other women's team in history has ever done. Like,
well, if you go back to that first half, that shot that hit the post from Kristen Preff, I believe, no, I think it was Crystal Dunn. The shot from Crystal Dunn from like 30 yards out.
It was Preff.
It was Preff? Wow, yeah. That hit that post, and I was like, oh my. And a couple, this could have been 5-0. Like, two clear opportunities here, a save by LeBay, or a hit the post, and then save by LeBay. It was, though, I have to say, you're absolutely right. And the way the U.S. Women's National Team played against Canada is not only, like you mentioned, a very athletic performance, which is not mean in a denigrating way here. Like, they're on top of being technical, which they are, the most, maybe one of the most technical team in the world with their players. They're also very athletic and they are tactical also, which leads me to how they adjusted versus Canada after the first half, where Canada was able to create some opportunity, was able to absorb the pressure of the U.S. and was able to, with their new tactic of 1-2 touch max and progressing on the pitch, they were finding ways to not necessarily break down the U.S., but to create at least some chances. U.S. adjusted, and the press that they actually did against Canada in the second half, you could see Canada losing steam by the minute, and it was all generated because of that unrelenting pressure that U.S. did put in that second half. And yeah, it's just an example of that athleticism that you're mentioning without taking anything away from their tactical awareness, which created that opportunity for the athleticism to be effective and very efficient, and also their technical ability on the ball. Like we mentioned, that shot of Kristen Prest, a few opportunities of Kristen Dunn. When Rapinoe came in the second half, who can have the Ballon d'Or on their bench, bring him in the second half and change how things are going? Yeah, you're talking about a very good team, Dwayne.
Well, yeah, which is why you shouldn't use the game against the U.S. as your ultimate measure of how to evaluate Canada's overall performance in the tournament. And Jonathan Tannenwald and I will go a lot deeper onto the U.S. side of things and what they gain from this tournament and where they sort of stand in service of their roster selection on Women's Soccer Review this week, which we haven't quite scheduled it yet, but it will come out later this week when we'll break down the whole tournament in its full. But to focus on Canada for this show right now, look, I have said before that it feels like the end of the era where Canada gets a free pass into these major tournaments. It has backtracked before on me. I thought 4 years ago when I was having this conversation that it would already be the case where they would be struggling to qualify. I guess a 1-0 win against Costa Rica could be considered as struggling to qualify, although they were the better team in that match. They just could not produce the final ball.
They could have scored like 3-4, and they barely gave any expected goal chances to Costa Rica, if any. So, no, I I understand that sentiment. That's on paper, it's only a 1-0 victory, but it was never really truly in jeopardy.
Yeah. Other than their inability to finish, which was the same problem in the World Cup. And this is what I've said about the Canadian team for a while now. I mean, we focus a lot, and I think in Canada, because, again, and this is their own making. They have held themselves up, well, famously, in 2015, they said they were World Cup contenders. Famously, I disagreed. And lots of people that were paying attention to the games disagreed. And it proved it, you know, without patting ourselves in the back, those, and I'm not happy about this, but those that were suggesting that they were far from that were correct. Which, the results proved it out.
And there's a reason for that. And I'm sorry if I'm stepping on your point you were trying to make, but yesterday, watching On One Soccer, and I thought Carmelina Moscato really explained it perfectly. Like, yeah, the World Cup in 2015, it's great, but the fact that it was at home gives you an expectation of results, and it's a World Cup year, too. So, well, it's like an Olympic year before that. Actually, it was the year after. So, you're not ready to peak. Your cycle is 4-year cycle to peak at the Olympics with your roster that you want, not at the World Cup. It's unfortunate that the World Cup is not the be-all, end-all yet. In the women's game, the Olympics still has that connotation of being the true determination of factor in who's the best team in the world. So, that's really what Canada was gearing for, right? So that explains 2015. It's just to point out that, yeah, it's a different approach than the World Cup in the men's side or in other type of soccer. The Olympic tournament is still the be-all, end-all, number one. Number two is the World Cup, of course.
I disagree, and I think most of the world disagrees. The World Cup is by far surpassing the Women's Olympic Tournament now for most of the major countries, including the United States. But Canada may still continue to make that focus, and it makes sense if they did, because they do get a lot of their direct funding through their Olympic being a top 8 team in the world. So they're considered an A card in the Olympic side. We're going to get a little five rings here for a second. So they do get a ton of money for that. So it does make sense that the Canadian program may prioritize that, and other nations may too as well. Japan, I think, prioritizes the Olympic tournament because they're hosting it this year as well. So it's not as cut and dry on the men's side, but I don't think it's quite – the Olympics are – they're the top end of the cycle, because there's a lot of people that will argue it the opposite way, that the Olympics start a cycle. But, you know, that's part of the parcel of the women's game and the differences therein. Look – Canada still could medal in Tokyo because the field is weaker than a World Cup. And that's why there's a difference, is because the field is weaker. You can get out with a much weaker performance and one win, and suddenly you're in a medal game. One win in a knockout game is what I'm saying. So it's a bit of an easier path. And I think that, you know, there is an element of Canada choosing to focus on that as their priority. But if that is their priority, they have a lot of work to do, because they got a lot. They lost 4-0 to Japan earlier this year. And they got smacked 3-0 by the U.S. And, well, those are two teams that might be in the podium. So, you know, there you go. They have a lot of big games coming up. They play Germany and France next month. They play Australia after that. We're going to know a lot more about the team there. The final thought I have on Kevin, and look, by playing, I hosted a lot of these games, and I spent a lot of time on social media talking about these games over the last 2 weeks, and you end up with a whole on different kind of experience on social media, and I appreciate social media's its own thing too, but I start to meet some new people, right? And they're people that follow the Canadian women's program but don't follow any other part of Canadian soccer. And there was this sort of anger about the fact that they're not dominating more, that they're not able to smack down Costa Rica or compete more with the US, and this demand to have more funding and more support and things like that out there. And look, what frustrates me about that is it's not that they're wrong completely. We could use some more friendlies. We could use some more support, all that sort of stuff. It's that they're parachuting in. And this has always been my issue with the armchair critics of this program. This program has done very well to get to where it is. It has hit a ceiling that is nowhere near what they claim it to be, and that's their own messaging problem. But to just throw them out and dismiss them and say that they're crap, or that the CSA doesn't care, is silly comments, right? They do care. They just only have they're a government agency. They can't just spend $10 million because they want to or have to or whatever. And they do equally fund the two programs. And, you know, I've had people argue that they shouldn't equally fund the men because the men don't do as well. Well, you're talking about apples and oranges there. It's just a conversation we've been having for years. Look, I have come to peace with where the women are. I want them to succeed, but I recognize, and I don't want to be the guy that has to constantly damper the expectations. And I think that finally the expectations have been dampered by a certain amount of people. But that said, there's a lot of people in this country that know the Canadian women's program very well because of their Olympic success. Bronze medals are successful, but that's all they know. They don't watch this team outside of those 2 weeks every 4 years. And that's why perhaps the Canadian women's program focuses on the Olympics more, because that's where they get their popularity and their attention from.
Are you saying it's not the Cyprus Cup that really gets people going?
No, there's a lot of people that don't even know that they play in those tournaments. They think, I had someone say that they only played one game last year.
No,
they played 14.
They play as many as you can. The thing is,
other than the U.S., they play a normal amount of games.
Yeah, the U.S. plays just because way more games because they can. Exactly. And not only can they afford it, they can draw a crowd, which I guess wasn't really present in Carson on Sunday at the Dignity Sports and Health, whatever it's called, stadium. But yeah, that stadium in Carson.
Where the Galaxy play.
I was going to say where the Chargers play. Yeah. You know, that note will keep and continue to follow the Olivier Renard story coming out of Belgium for sure. It has the potential of being the story of the last few months coming out of Montreal. That says a lot. But again, you can find the facts on the earlier today's show and on rtbf.be. You can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Laramie, and this show at Soccer Today SBN. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of The World of Football with a Soccer Perspective. Until then, you can get our premium podcast at sportspodcastingnetwork.com. You can find the link there or at patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. But as always, until tomorrow, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.